It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with a genetic researcher about efforts to sequence the entire planet's DNA and how that'll support human life in the future.
First, when we talk about Wisconsin's economy, we usually focus on things like job creation and unemployment. But one key step toward job creation is business creation. So how does Wisconsin perform when it comes to entrepreneurship or creating startups?
According to a new report from the Kauffman Foundation, the answer is pretty bleak. The state ranked last in the nation for startup activity, with Milwaukee ranking 39th out of 40 of the country's largest metropolitan areas.
John Eckhart joins us now for a look at the details. He's the executive director of the Weinert Center for Entrepreneurship and an associate professor of management at UW-Madison. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, as someone who researches this topic, works closely with entrepreneurs, how significant is this bad news about Wisconsin startups for the state?
So it's important for people to understand that the Kauffman Foundation is doing a very good job with this index. This represents some very careful work. It's one of the best measures we have of entrepreneurship across the economy that you could use to kind of look and compare states. Having said that, and within that discussion, essentially, there's not a lot of good news in a sense that, you know, you can look at the data in different ways, and it's almost impossible to imagine that Wisconsin would be top 10. And so for those of us that aspire to perform well in entrepreneurship, this is not good news. It's not exciting. On the other side, it's very difficult to use the same data that they're using here and know if we're number 30 or number 50. So I think the way to kind of interpret it from that standpoint is this is good information. This is good data. This is probably not as bad as people are expecting, but it certainly isn't good news. And we can talk in a little bit maybe about how this index is calculated and then help people understand it a little bit better.
And to look at that state measure, Wisconsin fell 5 rankings from the last time this measure was taken. Is that particularly alarming? Or are you going to measure that out with some different variables too?
Well, the index is very different this year than years past. It's computed in a way that it's a little better. So in years past, it was based on just one measure. The rate of new entrepreneurs in the U.S. economy or their estimate of that by each state. And that's really looking at within the adult population and how many people within the state started new firms. What happened this year is they added 2 more measures, something called the opportunity share of new entrepreneurs, and that's the portion of those people that started firms that left a current job, for example, to start the new company. And the idea is that they probably left for greener pastures in comparison to somebody who maybe was unemployed and then started a new company. And this last measure is called the startup density, or the portion of firms within a region or a state that are employer firms, so they have at least one employee, divided by the total population. And this last measure is actually a 2012 number. So it's 3 years old. These other 2 measures are 3-year averages, with the last average being 2014.
Okay, so aside from those last 2 that are newer or changed, what else goes into determining that list?
So what these measures are doing, and maybe we can focus on the first one, is that it really is counting every single kind of entrepreneurship the same. Okay, and so what that means is that if somebody starts a coffee shop that's designed to serve customers locally, maybe within their neighborhood, that's counted in exactly the same way as an entrepreneurial endeavor where somebody is starting a software company where they aspire to serve customers all across the world. Okay, this is not good or it's not bad. It just is. And in fact, most of the index is counting things like coffee shops, bookstores, construction firms. It's more like counting things like that than software companies. And so that's where I think what a lot of us would really like to know is how good is Wisconsin at in starting companies that are going to grow fast and be like an epic that would employ lots of other people and impact economic development in our region. And the index, as far as I can tell, is very little about that. It's much more about kind of the smaller kind of businesses that are serving local customers.
So Epic being the healthcare software company based in Madison. So is there a way to get better data on companies like that, that you say employ lots of people and create an industry in a big job market?
And this is, I think, something to commend the Kauffman Foundation on, is that they're at this current point, there really isn't. So I know that they're working hard to come up with better measures, but what they're doing is they're very clever. They took a national survey that's very reputable. That's actually the same survey that we used every month to report the official unemployment numbers for the U.S. economy. They looked at that survey, and then it wasn't designed to track entrepreneurship, but they're using it to try and measure entrepreneurship. On the downside, it's the best you can do. There really isn't a good measure that at the moment that can give us the precision that we'd like to focus on industries and types of firms and so on.
No, it seems like when you look at an impact on the economy point of view, the EPIC sort of model where they're creating a lot of jobs, starting an industry, going beyond the borders of the state, that has higher impact on the state. But do we also care equally about the people who are starting the single business, the hair salon, the coffee shop?
Absolutely. They're all fundamentally important to economic development. And a vibrant economy makes it easy for people to start the businesses that they would like to start that they feel their community needs. And so for sure, the coffee shops, restaurants, it's very much part of what makes Madison a very special place in my view. And they're very much large contributors to employment in the economy.
Now, let's focus in on some of these big job creator type startups. What does a city need to do? What does a state need to do to foster a good place to grow companies like that?
So if you want to focus on maybe some of the opportunities before us, from my perspective, one of the things that I see that gets me excited but also a little bit frustrated is that as a professor at the university, I get to teach amazing people. They come here from all over the world, all over the state, all over the country. They come to UW-Madison, and they do amazing work. They study very hard. And what often happens is that we train them really well, and then they leave the state. And that's unfortunate. You know, some of them stay, but many of them leave. And there's some things the university has been doing to try to directly address this. So in the past, about 3 years, what we've done is we've shifted – how we train entrepreneurs on campus and also who we're training to try and make a landing spot for more of these students to come and stay. And the major focus here is that we're trying to give people the skill set but also the mindset so that they feel confident in betting on themselves by starting a new company instead of waiting to bet on themselves until later in their economic lives. And then the second thing we're doing is we've literally opened the doors to entrepreneurship courses to the entire campus where it used to be kind of a secret thing that was left only to business students. And so our enrollment has gone from just a few hundred students that were all business students to well over 1,200 students from all across the campus, postdocs, PhDs, undergrads, engineers, people in LNS that come in and learn about entrepreneurship while they're on the campus.
So how do those things convince people to stay in Wisconsin? Is it just a sheer numbers game? If there's more of them are likely to stay?
So that's a great question. And one of the other things that I saw is I would look out in the community. My pitch to the students was, look, you should be an entrepreneur. And the other half of it is you should be one here or can think about being one here. And if you look at Madison and in the state, I think it's an area where there's some struggles and then there's some opportunities and some new developments. So one thing that I became involved in is I'm a co-founder of a seed investment fund and a business accelerator called Generator. And this project is very much the brainchild of a gentleman by the name of Joe Kurgis, who is a Milwaukee businessman, and Troy Vossler, who's here in Madison. And what we basically do is we help aspiring entrepreneurs who want to grow these and create these high technology companies, we try and make it easier for them by leveraging our community and getting them resources and capital and training them so that they can be better off. And in the last 3 years, we've helped get off the ground and accelerate over 30 companies. They employ several hundred people. And they've raised over $40 million in venture capital from investors from all across the country.
We're talking right now with John Eckert, Executive Director of the Weinert Center for Entrepreneurship, talking about some new numbers for entrepreneurship in Wisconsin. Wisconsin at the bottom of the list as a state and also the city of Milwaukee. And let's talk now about Milwaukee. It ranked 39 out of 40 large metropolitan areas in the country for startup activity. Only city lower than that is Pittsburgh. So what challenges specifically do you see happening in Milwaukee?
So I have had the opportunity to spend a fair amount of time in Milwaukee as part of my work at Generator in the university. And what I basically see there is opportunity in an area of expertise that we don't always understand is important to entrepreneurship. And what that is that when we think of entrepreneurs, we often think of the founder, maybe an iconic entrepreneur, and they have an idea, and then they build a company. And one of the things that they really need is expertise on how to run that company at all managerial levels. And Milwaukee has expertise, broad expertise in a variety of industries where you have middle managers and people that can run budgets and run factories and everything else that are in that city, literally, that can help entrepreneurs form and manage those kinds of companies in a way that we don't have in Madison. On the other side, you know, I think maybe because we have these large employers in Milwaukee, and for the most part, they're quite successful, people are happy where they are, and they're less likely to take that leap, that jump into a new opportunity. And that's in part it's frustrating for me as an entrepreneurship professor, but it's also kind of a good thing in a sense that they are happily employed while they're in Milwaukee.
Now, John, just briefly as we wrap up, do you think that lawmakers are doing enough to address the problem of creating a favorable climate for entrepreneurs in Wisconsin?
So, you know, there's many things that are percolating in the Capitol, and as you know, I'm not on top of all different legislation that's there. I think two things that you know I really like to focus on is one is that it's important that we have labor mobility, that we have a legal framework where it's easy for people to leave their current employer and start a company. And there are some changes in employment law that are being considered that hopefully will not add restrictions to that. Secondarily, this whole discussion around the university is that the university really drives entrepreneurship and economic development in two ways from my perspective. One, it's these amazing technologies that are invented on our campus that become the core to firms, that are created that employ people, and maybe CDI is a great example of that. But the other thing we overlook and we forget is that there are tens of thousands of people that come to Wisconsin because of Madison, because of the university, that are studying almost every topic known to humankind at a very high level. And they go do things. They go start companies, and they learn how to do that while we're here. And I hope that we focus going forward more on the opportunities and how to enable that and make that more effective and less on ways of making that machine smaller and not as effective.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to John Eckert, Executive Director of the Weinert Center for Entrepreneurship and Associate Professor of Management at UW-Madison, talking about a new report that ranks Wisconsin as last in the nation for entrepreneurial activity.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll hear about the call to action on climate change issued today by Pope Francis.
First, from unraveling the human genome to detecting disease, the ability to read DNA has radically changed how we look at life.
A new global effort is trying to map the entire planet's biocode, and this may have profound implications for understanding nature and how we fit into it.
Dawn Field joins us now. She's a research fellow of the Biodiversity Institute of Oxford and co-founder of the Genomic Observatories Network. She's the co-author of the new book called Biocode, The New Age of Genomics. Dawn, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So biocode, what do we mean by that term?
Biocode. So a lot of people are talking about DNA as software. It's a nice analogy. It makes life run. It has the instructions, and it makes life. And so the biological code is something that's found on all of Earth. And we found that when we were looking at studies on DNA, it's impacting all aspects of life, whether it's human studies, medicine, agriculture, looking at biodiversity. It was all part of this one biological code. And so we figured that was a nice title for the book. We also toyed with making it the Planetary Genome Project, which is sort of what's going on now. But we stuck with biocode as the sum of all DNA on Earth.
Now, back in 2001, we had that first map of a human genome released, a huge achievement at the time. But now, wow, we're talking about trying to map the entire genome of more or less everything on the planet. How far has our understanding of DNA and genomes come since 2001?
Right, that's a great question. So a great point. The first genome was actually a composite of several people because they were worried about anonymity and they wanted diversity. And, of course, we realized quite quickly that the real value of genomics is looking at individual differences. So now they're talking about a million genome projects. And that kind of technology has brought down the cost of sequencing such that people in labs across the world can apply this technology to other species. So all life has DNA, and people are sequencing almost everything. And there's not one designated biocode project or planetary genome project, but people are looking into all avenues of life, and together this is like sequencing the Earth.
And how far are we away from this, having effectively every species on the planet mapped, gene sequenced?
So it seems like we're doing a lot, and we are. There are lots of tens of thousands of genome projects now going on. And yet what's startling is that there are more than 10 million species on Earth, and we still don't know how many there are. And one of the problems in figuring this out is that most of life is invisible. So 99% of all genetic diversity is invisible, and it's the microbes, and they're on us. We've heard a lot about the microbiome, how they're in our guts, they help us live. But they're everywhere. They're driving metabolism of the oceans. Every second breath of oxygen you take is from a microbe in the ocean. They're pretty important, and we're starting to understand this with DNA. So we have huge treasure trove of DNA now building up in these public libraries of DNA, but we have a vast way to still go.
I want to key in on what you said about the ecosystem inside us. We think of ecosystems as, you know, a jungle or other biome, but people are starting to look at our intestinal flora and fauna as an ecosystem all of its own. What are we doing with mapping that out and the DNA sequences? What are we learning there?
So there's an explosion of interest. You have about 3 pounds of microbes in your gut. That's the same as your brain. And as people find out how much the gut influences behavior, how you eat, how you lose weight, how you gain weight, what your mood is, we're realizing how absolutely important that entire ecosystem is, and it's thousands of species. And again, the take-home message from this is that we're learning more and more about specific species, but most of them are unknown. So even in our own bodies, the biodiversity around us is overwhelming.
And you say in the book, this is part of what we're learning in DNA, how we're not separate from nature, how our DNA overlaps us as individuals with the individuals living inside us and with the rest of nature. What kind of perspective are we getting as we learn more and more about the DNA makeup of our planet?
That's what we tried to focus on the book. We both work in biodiversity genomics, so microbes in the ocean or microbes in a tropical island, and looking at systems. But what we found is more and more we were thinking about the human genome as sort of a marker and a vision for where we could go with all of genomics. So humans are just one species. We happen to know the most about them because we care the most, but we're sequencing almost everything around us. And we can't live in isolation. If we come back to your microbiome, we can show that it's quite stable in healthy individuals. So people have looked, for example, at an individual over the course of a year. And yet if you get food poisoning, for example, it can completely disrupt your microbiome, and we know how sick you get. And that's part of your environment. So we're learning these connections from a single organism up through to the planet. And that's where it gets really exciting. We're just getting that technology to sort of think and conceptualize how we might start looking at this entire biocode, this living system.
One thing that's exciting here is that there's too much science in a way for just the scientists. You point out that citizen science is playing a big role in this effort to map the planetary genome.
So we launched a project called Ocean Sampling Day, which involved lots of people around the world taking samples of ocean water and looking at microbes. And this was just one of many projects that also involved citizen scientists. So people can go out and help test the water for different parameters. But it's going beyond that. Many people are contributing their genomes or genomes of their pets. There's a kitty microbiome project going on. People really can get involved, whether it's through academic projects or whether it's through consumer genetics. Of course, you can pay money and have your own genome or your microbiome sequenced now. And it's this collective pool of information and this sort of bioliteracy that's growing that's really going to start to change things.
On the frontiers of all this, maybe efforts to create genomes, DNA sequences, viable ones, not created by nature, created by humans. How close are we to that?
So Craig Venter has already copied a living bacterium, so put the DNA into a computer, so to speak, synthesized it again, put it back into a bacterium and showed that he had a working organism, and he called her Cynthia. The trick is coming up with new organisms. But we talk about this in the book, that we have this tree of life. It's ancient. Life is 3.5 billion years old. And all of a sudden, we're on the cusp of potentially creating new life. And we've had recombinant DNA for a while, for example, growing insulin in E. coli. That's how most diabetics get their insulin. It's recombinant DNA, but we're moving steps farther. And some visionaries have put ideas on the table, like trees that glow in the dark, so that along streets you don't have to have electricity in the future, and this will be done with genetic engineering. So sort of the book of life is about to be written. We don't know how much of the tree of life we're going to add new, but the potential is certainly there.
Have we had the ethical conversations that we need to have before that happens?
A lot of people don't think we have yet, and the technology is going so fast. There's a lot of debate, especially around gene editing, these CRISPR-Cas sequences where you can target any gene in a genome and rewrite it in situ. And people have started to show that you can do this even in the human germline. And this is really starting to make people think about where could this technology go. It's not science fiction anymore. You could actually change humans as people are changing plants. There was a mosquito story with changing mosquitoes, the sex of mosquitoes, because only females bite. So now you can change their genes. They all become male, and you rid the world of different diseases carried by mosquitoes. Much of it could be great. It depends on how it is used. But there needs to be a very healthy debate about this kind of technology.
Well, it seems like, you know, if the space program were going this fast, I'd be talking to you from Alpha Centauri. Briefly, Dawn, is this an exciting time to be in genomics?
Absolutely. And this is the big message of the book, is despite all these fantastic advances, it's just starting. And it will continue to explode, we think, until the next decade. This is a century of biology, and genomics is at the heart of it.
Dawn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That was Dawn Field, research fellow of the Biodiversity Institute of Oxford. She's the co-author of the new book, BioCode, The New Age of Genomics.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll talk to a hate crime expert about last night's shooting at a black church in South Carolina.
First, after much anticipation, a sweeping letter from Pope Francis was released today on the topic of climate change. In it, the Pope acknowledged climate change as a global problem, he said, caused by humans, and he says that we have a moral obligation to do something about it.
It's the first papal encyclical to be focused solely on the environment, and it's a call to action, not just for the 1.2 billion Catholics of the world, but, quote, every person living on this planet, end quote. It's a move, though, that puts him at odds with some political conservatives here in the U.S. who have expressed skepticism over climate change in the past.
Here with us now to talk about the Pope's proclamation and what it could mean going forward is John O'Keefe. He's a professor of theology at Creighton University, where, among other things, he studies environmental theology. John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, John, first off, in your opinion, how significant is this document from the Pope?
I think it's profoundly significant. As you mentioned, it's the first papal encyclical devoted exclusively to the environment. Previous popes have mentioned this, but none have written an entire letter on it. It's really timely. I think it's pretty hard-hitting and challenging in all kinds of ways.
And what do you make of the fact that the letter is not just directed at the world's Catholics, but it's directed to every person living on the planet?
Well, that's not totally surprising. Other papal documents have been addressed to people of goodwill around the world, and so that's part of the tradition of some of these documents, is to open it up to a wider audience. I think this is the first one I'm aware of that has been addressed to all the people of the world, though, so that's different. And I really do think the Pope is trying to open up a conversation between Catholics and the rest of the world on the issue of environment, and trying to make common cause. So the document contains a lot of stuff that's really for Christians, for Catholic Christians in particular, but it also contains a lot of information. Now, information is the wrong word, but a lot of challenges and reflections on how we might actually enter into conversation with the whole human community.
So let's talk a little bit about the way that the Pope delivered that message. It's something called an encyclical, and it's something not everybody might be familiar with. What is it, and how is it usually used?
Well, in the Roman Catholic Church, the most authoritative voice that can come out of the church is an ecumenical council, which is a gathering of bishops. And the last time that happened was back in the 60s at the Second Vatican Council. And they're not very common occurrences. So in like the last 2,000 years, there's only been like 21 of them. So normally when a pope writes or speaks authoritatively from his office, the highest document he can issue is an encyclical. So this is at the top of the food chain in terms of papal authority.
So is this now part of the teaching of the Catholic Church that Catholics are
Absolutely.
Now intended to follow?
Well, they have to take it seriously. Now, yes, certainly, every pope issues encyclicals. And this one is part of a tradition of encyclicals going back to the 19th century, beginning with Rerum Novarum, which forms a body of Catholic social teaching. So it's in that tradition. And there's a lot of these along the way. So Catholics are expected to engage them and think about them, try to internalize them. But certainly not every Catholic's going to agree with all of the content. But they're asked, invited, and encouraged to take them as seriously as they can.
Well, let's get into what he said a little bit. One of the most profound things that people are pointing to is that he has made a moral case for climate change action. How significant is that?
Well, I think that's one of the things that religion can do, and Christianity can offer a moral voice to these topics. I mean, science can expose the reality of the problem, but then we need to reflect morally and ethically on what that demands of us, and how are we going to live, and how are we going to change our lives, and it is a moral issue. You know, it's not. It's unfortunate in the United States that it's been so politicized, and many people think it's just a part of partisan politics, but it really is about how we live in the world and how, and our life on Earth and our life with each other on the Earth and our life with other creatures of the Earth. So it's about as moral as it gets as far as I'm concerned.
But it's something that scientists can't do. Scientists don't make moral cases. They make scientific cases. So in that respect, having a moral aspect to the climate change argument from science, do you think that makes a sort of a juggernaut for the case to get working on climate change?
Yeah, and I mean, I've thought this for a long time because I've been talking to students about issues of environmental justice and climate and the morality of that and the problems of that for a long time, like coming up on 10 years now. And, you know, I think there's an unfortunate tendency in our culture to pit science and religion against each other rather than to see them as potentially doing common cause. And, you know, science, as I said, can expose these problems, but it's not really, the scientific method isn't designed to reflect ethically. And so, you know, if a religious voice like the Pope's can engage the science with these kinds of ethical concerns, it can be a real powerful combination, I think.
What would you say about the core of Pope Francis's message here today?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, it's certainly an affirmation that we've got a big problem. It's very hard-hitting. It doesn't hold back at all. It acknowledges not only that climate is a problem, but global environmental devastation is a giant problem. And I think this encyclical is coming really from the experience of the developing world, which is actually very new for papal documents. This is the first pope to come out of the developing world, and I think you really can see it in this document. It really expresses the concerns of poverty in the third world. And so he is very careful to link the problems of environmental destruction, including climate change, to the problems of intense and poverty in the developing world. So that's really consistent with everything he's said since he's been pope. Real deep concern for the poor and the needs of the poor and their plight.
And he did come down on the side of science. He referenced scientific studies. Was that a lingering
right.
question? The people weren't really sure how he was going to handle that one.
Well, I wasn't. I had no doubt that he would do that because that's really consistent with Catholicism for a long time. I think a lot of people have the impression that there's this war with science, and certainly within some Christian groups there is, that science is seen as opposed to religion, science is opposed to the Bible. But in Catholicism, we've made peace with science a long time ago. So dialogue with science is part of the Catholic tradition. That to me is not surprising in any way.
Now, the tone of the letter, to talk about that for a little bit, you could characterize it at times as blunt. In one passage, he writes, "The earth, our home, is beginning to look more and more like an immense pile of filth." That's strong language.
Yeah.
Is that unusual for a pope?
I think this is pretty strong. It's not unusual to be strong. I mean, if you read some of the social encyclicals, even of Pope Benedict, who's not known for being a sort of a liberal Catholic, there's some really hard-hitting language in there about consumerism and overconsumption. So these themes are really clear. I read that passage you just referred to, and I immediately thought, I don't know if you've traveled much in the developing world, but there are places that have just been utterly ravished, completely ravished by human exploitation and deforestation, just massive pollution. And this is an experience that people in our part of the world don't have as much. Maybe they did 100 years ago. But people in the part of the world where he comes from and Cardinal Turkson, who was from Africa, is involved in writing this, comes from. These are real and ongoing problems. So I think he's talking about the devastating impact that unchecked human activity can have on the environment in that passage. And he should be blunt, because that's what's happening.
Do you see the Pope making any enemies with this? On the one hand, he criticized technology and economic interests as being sort of short-term gain over the long term. He criticized cap and trade, a major component of climate change policy right now. So do you think that's going to ruffle any feathers?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it's already ruffling feathers. I mean, I just came out this morning, so I spent the day kind of reading through the document. I haven't even had time to really look at the fallout. But, yeah, there will always be that kind of thing. All of the encyclicals produce that kind of blowback, and doesn't surprise me. I mean, this was one of the things that's really interesting about this document is that even before it was published, I mean, months before it was published, there were people trying to refute it, which is bizarre that you would try to refute a document that didn't exist. But now that it does exist, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of pressure from certain circles, and a lot of people won't like it.
We're talking right now with theologian John O'Keefe from Creighton University. On our minds today is the encyclical from Pope Francis addressing the issue of climate change and what he says we as humans should be doing about it.
You could join in with your questions, your comments at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the Pope's call to action on climate change? Do you think we as humans have a moral obligation to do something about climate change, as the Pope has said? If so, how would you like to see that translated into action? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment. But first, a check of the latest headlines with Noah Ovshinsky from WPR News.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking right now about Pope Francis and his call to action on climate change. His 184-page open letter was released today, and in that letter, he reframes environmental stewardship as a moral and a spiritual concern.
What do you think? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the Pope? Are you glad to see this call? Or do you think, as some, including presidential candidates here in the United States, do you think the Pope should stay out of these sort of scientific and political issues? What kind of action would you like to see taken on climate change? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post also on the Central Time Facebook page.
And John, critics of the Pope, some have said that he's really got no business wading into the debate over the environment and climate change, that this is maybe an area that theologians should stay out of. And some of these people running for office for president, how would you respond to those critiques?
Well, I mean, if you're running for president, you have to be political, right? But I'm not running for president, so I don't need to be political. I don't really see how you can separate how we live as in common, which is the, sort of the essence of political life, with moral questions. And what is going to happen to the world that we inhabit is a deeply moral question. And I mean, I have four children, and I think a lot about their future. And I mean, I don't want to be one of those people that, you know, 20 years from now, they look at me and with disgust about what I didn't do. And one of the things that's really interesting in this letter, I mean, this is actually a theme that goes back to Pope Benedict, is this idea of intergenerational justice, that we have a moral obligation to care for the generations yet to come and to put them in the formula and not think just about short-term gain. So, you know, those guys, those politicians, that's what they need to do to survive, I suppose, but I don't think that really changes the reality that this is maybe the deepest moral problem ever to face the human race.
And you mentioned families, children, and interesting, in this document, the Pope said the problem isn't overpopulation. That's sort of a stand-in,
right,
for not addressing the bigger problems. What are your thoughts on that stance?
Yeah, you know, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, you know, the Catholic Church has controversial positions on population control. And I read that section really carefully, and it seems to me, you know, what they're trying to say is that we don't want to – what he's really after is reducing or challenging the idea of overconsumption. And what he was saying is that it's not enough just to reduce the population of the earth. What we need to do is think about living more sustainably on the earth and taking care of the people who are here already. So just thinking about the problem as, oh, if only we could just keep living the way we're living and get rid of the 2 billion people at the bottom of the world, then everything would be fine, is a mistake. And I think he's right about that. That's not what we need.
We go now
we've
to
got a problem of overconsumption.
And we're going to go now to our callers. We've got Tina on the line in Mount Horeb. Hi, Tina.
Hi there. I think that this a role for him to do this. We're supposed to, you know, take care of the earth and each other, and just all of the different religious teachings that are out there. It seems to fall in line with it. I mean, I haven't read what exactly he said, but the one thing that's been kind of cool about him in general is just all of these different statements that are just considered so amazing by, or shocking, considered so shocking by some. But
got it, Tina. Thank you for that. And Tina's comments remind me of a little soundbite from the NPR newscast saying that this positions him as a major geopolitical player. Do you see this as doing that for his role right now?
Yeah, I do. And I was thinking about this the other day. And I really do like Pope Francis. I'll just go on record for that. But he's really used the role that he's been given very well. And I'm frankly amazed at the interest globally in this document. I mean, it is routine, really, for popes to issue encyclicals. I mean, you don't have a papacy without an encyclical unless the pope dies or something. It's just part of what they do. But I've never in my whole career now seen this much interest in a papal document. So I think it says a lot about his personality.
And do you see this pope as just getting started on this, or do you think what he has done today is going to be hard to top?
I think it's going to be hard to top. I mean, if he stays pope, you know, longer, he will certainly issue another encyclical. I don't know what it will be about, but this is a real achievement, I think, and very important. I think we're going to be talking about it for a long time. I'm really looking forward to a careful, slow read and sharing it with my students and things like that. It's a very significant document, I think.
And as we wrap up, what sort of reaction have you seen from Catholics so far to this?
Well, most of the reaction I've been getting is from Twitter, and the people that I follow are all just very, very happy about this and really excited. I mean, I've been following for a long time the work of the Catholic Climate people in D.C., and there is this Catholic, the St. Francis Pledge, I think they just renamed themselves, but there's that, and there's the Ignatian Solidarity Network, and I'm part of a network of Jesuit universities, and there's been a very strong interest in environmental stuff for a while now, and we're just, all of us are so happy to see it rise to this level of attention. So the feedback I'm getting is just overwhelmingly positive, and I know that's not universal, but it's certainly the people that I'm associated with, people are feeling pretty good about this.
And just briefly, now that the Pope has gotten this message out to the more than 1 billion Catholics, what do you hope happens next?
Well, I think the best thing that could happen, really, the people that need to hear this most are the people that live in the developed world, you know, the Catholics like me. And I think what I hope happens is that people listen and really begin to reform their lives. So the last chapter is really a call to change. And I think that's what needs to happen. We really need to think comprehensively about what we're doing and how we're living on this world.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was John O'Keefe, professor of theology at Creighton University, where, among other things, he studies environmental theology. He joined us to talk about the Pope's call to action on climate change.
Governor Walker's proposal for a new basketball arena in Milwaukee is kind of a jump ball among state legislators. Milwaukee land developers want those lawmakers to tip the package forward. Others want to bat it backwards or at least call a timeout for now. Chuck Kurenbach reports on the latest.
Usually when governors and key lawmakers announce a financing package for a project, it's pretty smooth sailing from there on in. That appeared to be the case a couple of weeks ago when Governor Walker and other Republican leaders announced their Cheaper to Keep Them plan for the new Bucks Arena in Milwaukee.
I'm joined by the leadership of the state legislature, the speaker, the majority leader, co-chair, the Senate co-chair of the Finance Committee, and a number of great lawmakers.
Walker and the others spelled out the general proposal. There'd be $80 million in borrowed dollars from the state, plus financing from Milwaukee County, the city of Milwaukee, and the Wisconsin Convention Center District. Current and past owners of the Milwaukee Bucks would still put up the other half of the funding, $250 million, plus pay for any cost overruns. But in Madison, Milwaukee, and elsewhere, liberals who don't want tax money to help wealthy basketball team owners have joined with conservatives who don't want tax money to go to basketball. And by this week, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss was saying his fellow Republicans need to see details, and he doesn't yet have the GOP votes for the arena package.
I think there are always folks who have concerns about big projects like this when it is especially directed at one part of the state. You know, even though people from all across Wisconsin can attend something at the Bradley Center, I think we can be honest and say it's mostly people who live, you know, from Madison east.
Likewise, Senate Republicans are divided. The holding pattern at the Capitol has caught the eye of some pro-arena business people in Milwaukee.
Does anybody need a press release?
Mike Brzezicka and about a dozen other leaders of the real estate and construction industries held a news conference on the gravel lot that could be turned into a $500 million arena, with hundreds of millions of dollars more in related projects nearby. Tammy Madente of the First Weber Group Wisconsin downplayed local concerns that Milwaukee County would sell the arena site to the Bucks for $1.
The dollar here is a deal because of the catalytic development that will incur because of the Bucks and the millions it will bring to city, county, and state government.
The proposed land sale is just one of the local concerns about the governor's arena financing plan. Another question is about jobs. Would a fair percentage of construction work go to Milwaukee firms owned by or that employ blacks and Latinos? Angela Walker of Wisconsin Jobs Now also wants agreements that workers inside the new arena would receive a living wage.
If this has to be, that it is a good deal for all involved, and that workers' needs are centered from construction to end-use jobs.
As the Milwaukee Bucks today tried out college players hoping to be chosen in this month's pro basketball draft, there came one more opinion on the new arena. One of those practicing was former Wisconsin Badgers star Josh Gosser, who grew up in Port Washington. Gosser says the Bucks are getting better and ought to have a new facility.
So getting a new arena, getting these new jerseys, new players, you know, a new coach in the past couple of years, that's where the buzz starts to come.
State and Milwaukee area officials may be debating the arena issue for weeks, especially if Republicans take the financing package out of the state budget and put it in separate legislation. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.